For many years, I had hoped to schedule Joyce Carol Oates on this program, and the opportunity at long last came in November. Wishing to make the most of this, I read about, 8 Joyce Carol Oates books in advance of the conversation. The interview was to take place in Otto Penzler's basement office at the Mysterious Bookshop in New York. There was just one problem. Otto Penzler didn't like me. You see, 5 years ago, I had written some satirical blog post about Penzler, something I barely remember. For all I know, I was drunk or stoned at the time. I probably banged it out in about 20 minutes. Anyway, what I did not know was that Penzler had neither the humor nor the ability to let any perceived slights roll off his back. Why is any of this important? Well, because during this program, I had the misfortune of having one of the audio channels, the channel that was actually recording Miss Oates' voice, blow out on me. Now, normally this would not have been a problem because I could have salvaged the sound from the other channel. Unfortunately, because Penzler is not the type who likes to give up a petty grudge, he decided to turn on what he insisted was a heater during the course of our conversation. So not only did this heater, which spewed out nothing but cold air, cause Miss Oates to shiver, but it also disrupted our conversation, and this heater is also the reason why Miss Oates, despite my best efforts with EQ and with noise removing tools, I mean, I tried everything, sounds like a robot for about 8 minutes of this conversation. It is also the reason why this episode contains the most passive-aggressive moment in the history of the Bat Segundo Show, which can also be experienced in the partial transcript available at the Bat Segundo website. So despite this setback, I do hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you. Okay, so I am here with Joyce Carol Oates, who is most recently the author of The Corn Maiden, as well as the editor of New Jersey Noir. Joyce, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
There is, of course, the inevitable question concerning your prolificity, and I'm going to try to phrase it in a way that's a little bit different. What was the last 3 or 4 words you wrote in longhand, and when did you do that?
In longhand? So I'm not sure how to answer that. I probably wrote something today.
Uh-huh.
But I don't remember what it was.
Okay.
I'm also a professor, and I'm teaching.
So yes.
I'm working with students.
Sure.
So I have kind of a complex life.
Absolutely. Well, in considering the ideas of nightmares as fiction, because, of course, this is The Corn Maiden and Other Nightmares, that's the title of this book, I think of John Hawkes, I think of Poe, I think of Kafka, I think of Shirley Jackson. The nightmares in The Corn Maiden, I think, differ because these tales are careful in the way that they relate psychological realism to the dream state. In the title novella, you juxtapose this troubled mother who is losing her daughter with this sacrificial ritual. There's the psychological grief in Helping Hands, which triggers a nightmare, which could be argued. In Fossil Figures, you described Eddie Waldman's work as artworks covered in dream/nightmare shapes. So I'm curious how psychological realism gives shape to these nightmares that are in your fiction. Do you find that without such realism, these nightmares can sometimes be too burly to contend with? Or?
Well, it's a very good question. I think it's a matter of what sort of genre one is working in.
Yeah.
If you're working in a horror or fantasy genre, you would have no hesitation about writing about the supernatural. But I tend often to write in a realistic mode. And of course, people in reality, people have dreams.
Mm-hmm.
So the psychic experience or the neurological experience of a dream is real,
yeah,
even though it's invisible. So when writing about dreams and nightmares, I'm not writing about a supernatural world at all. Particularly The Corn Maiden is completely realistic.
Yeah.
There's nothing in it that's far-fetched or particularly preposterous. Some of the other stories shade into the surreal, so the Edgar Allan Poe zone. And I think Shirley Jackson often moved into that zone where there were supernatural figures.
Well, violence, I have to bring that up. It's an ineluctable quality in your work as well. In Beersheba, you have a character who is denied his diabetic shot and who experiences this very specific yet savage wound. At the end of A Fair Maiden, another book, you have a character bleeding from a deep cut above his right eye and cuts at his nose and mouth. You have, of course, the trepanning in a hole in the head. You have Herschel carving the swastika in Jeb Munzer's forehead in The Gravedigger's Daughter. I could go on. But what I'm interested in about this is how precise your violence is. And this leads me to wonder, well, you know, what do you do to get that level of precision? Does this come entirely from the imagination? Do you read a lot of police reports, a lot of true crime stuff? What of this?
I don't read any police reports or true crime material, really. I don't read about violence. I read about people.
Yeah.
And some of the people find themselves in dramatic or tragic situations in which violence is a consequence of some choices that they made or decisions that they made. But I don't set out to write about violence. It's more about human beings and their complexity, and they might make a bad decision. When Shakespeare writes his great tragedies of Macbeth and Othello, they are extraordinary people who've made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
They take a wrong turn. King Lear is another great example, and Hamlet. They're all examples, but the characters, Shakespeare's beginning with the characters. That's what interests him. And I begin with characters and with language, a certain tone or certain cadences and certain music. That to me is very interesting. It's interesting. I'm surprised that you mentioned the swastika cut in the forehead in the Grave Digger's Daughter, because that sort of came to me as I was writing that scene,
mm-hmm.
that this particular character has been so mistreated. His family of Jews have been treated so badly, and now it's his turn to get revenge, and he does something almost spontaneously,
yeah.
Even unconsciously. He carves the swastika in the head of his forehead of his enemy, but I didn't set out to write that.
Yeah.
It's more like it was a consequence of that character.
Well, that swastika certainly makes itself known in the text. But, I mean, describe this. I mean, how does such violence keep coming up in your work? Is it a matter of a character proving so feral that things end up that way? I mean, how does this exploration of the human condition lead to such stark and striking imagery?
Well, I'm writing tragic fiction usually. So tragedy deals with acts of violence that sometimes are ritualistic in works of tragedy by Aeschylus or Euripides. The acts of violence are offstage, or they happen before the action of the play. But it's couched in a certain ritualistic, almost ceremonial language. And that's what I'm more interested in, how people enact their destinies. I'm interested in maybe two people meeting, or three people, or a family moving through time, and encountering events that then translate into their personal destiny.
Yeah.
It's just a little cold in here.
Oh.
Hello, Otto?
Yeah.
Hi, it's just a little cold in here with that.
It's just cold?
It's...
That's the heater.
It's the heater?
It seems like a cool air.
It's actually like an air conditioner.
It's not. It's a heater, but turn it up.
Did it seem
it's
like
probably just because you're right in front of the vent, which is...
Okay. It seemed like an air conditioner.
Yeah, it seems cool air.
Yeah,
really, or is one of those heaters that take the length of this conversation to get started?
Yeah. But also it's a little distracting with the noise.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so I'm always really fascinated and even thrilled by dramatic encounters.
Mm-hmm.
People who meet and stories that are generated by the fact that they met.
Yeah.
And it's maybe accidental that they met, but then from that point onward, there's a certain destiny that enacts itself.
Yeah.
And I find that I'm just very, very fascinated by this. And I would never lose interest in that.
Yeah. But even in a book like My Sister, My Love, which is also quite stylistic and differs in that sense from the other books, there's this, I guess, this heightened sense of conflict. I mean, does it come largely from the language? Does it vary from project to project, the way that you eventually approach violence? Or is it just the nature of your psychological introspection here?
Well, My Sister, My Love is somewhat of a unique work because, as you said, it's an experiment, almost like an experiment in style. I wanted to write about a young person, either a young man or a young woman, who was the child of a tabloid family whose name was notorious.
Yeah.
So this young person, completely innocent and maybe good-hearted and sweet and intelligent, has to go through the world with this name. And for a while I was thinking about writing about someone who might have been, for instance, the child of O.J. Simpson.
Yes.
What would it be like to be that child? You'd grow up, everyone has an idea what your father is and what he did, and you can't change your identity. But finally, I thought I would write about the John Benet Ramsey case. So I knew about that because I had written about a couple of books on the subject. So I changed it and made her an ice skater instead of a model. And I changed the location to New Jersey and made it partly a satire of upper middle class, suburban people. And so the element of violence in it is probably like 1/900th of all that the novel is. And now it has so many other things on each page. There's so many other things going on.
It's the articulate sociopath that sort of lends itself to this sort of style.
Yes, and the young man is actually, he is actually innocent.
Yeah.
He's been made to feel that he's guilty, he's depraved, he's like a sex offender. He's been made to feel all these things falsely. Mm-hmm. So by the end of the novel, it's revealed that he is innocent. And so the novel takes us through a trajectory of something almost like health, like he's returning to health.
Yes.
He's returning to his own age, his contemporaries, his own generation, and he's freeing himself from the past. So the novel is somewhat unique in its structure and its ambition.
Yeah.
And it's partly a satire.
How does this more satirical mode in your writing sometimes come across? Because I also think of what I think is a very underrated novel of yours, which is Expensive People, which I think is actually very funny. And I think that a lot of people don't realize that there's actually a lot of humor in your work.
A lot
work.
Of humor.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I thought there was a lot of humor in My Sister, My Love.
Yes, me too. I mean, does this sort of heightened style lead you to kind of crack up more on the page? Or does this come from what we were talking about earlier in relation to this introspection of characters?
Well, it's more like a sense of the absurd.
Yeah.
That life is kind of funny and absurd. And when the person's telling his or her own story from that point of view, there's just so many more opportunities for irony and comedy and witticism. And in My Sister, My Love, both the young man who tells the story, Skyler, and his father have a penchant for malapropisms. They get words wrong.
Yes, yes.
And the father gets a lot of words wrong, and I had a lot of fun with that.
Yeah. Well, but that's not just My Sister, My Love. I see that every often. It's in A Fair Maiden to some degree, where she can't get certain words right. Like parquet, she can't quite, doesn't know if it's parquet or parquet and all that. Yes. I mean, does that sort of fluctuation of words, the smirching of words really lend you to, I mean, do you need to know your characters in relation to their language in order to allow this new form of language to come on the page? How does that work?
Yes, I think so. When the characters are developed at some length, there's more of a sense of the textuality of their language. In a short story like Beersheba, which moves fairly swiftly, there isn't that opportunity for the development of characters.
Yeah.
That's a story I would classify as more of a plot story, or a parable. It has a point to make, and it's more like a drama, whereas My Sister, My Love is more like a meditation.
Yeah. Well, this leads me to ask you, while we're on the subject of stories that are confined to plot, I want to ask you about one quality I've observed. In Helping Hands, you have Helene, the widow, she lets this mysterious man into her life, but she doesn't really check up on the guy. Beersheba, which we just mentioned, Brad goes into the middle of nowhere, but doesn't really ask questions. And the same goes for Katya Spivak in A Fair Maiden. She buys into the whole modeling thing, as well as her mother's phone call from Atlantic City. So this could very well be my own innate skepticism. But it seems to me that in many of your stories, especially the shorter ones or the novella-length ones, you have these characters who were willing to believe almost anything. And I'm wondering why you're interested in that type of figure in your work very often.
People who are somewhat heedless.
Yeah, people who are sort of not kind of asking that question of, maybe this isn't a good idea, maybe I shouldn't go in the car with this person who I barely know, and things like that.
Well, it's like the beginning of Macbeth.
Yeah.
What if Macbeth if you were Macbeth, you'd say, well, I don't believe there's witches. I don't believe in witches, so there's no play.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're sort of getting at the fundamental structure of drama is that there's conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody has to make a decision that's not a perfect decision.
Yeah.
If everyone made perfect decisions, the world would be perfect. So, and also in each of the stories that you mentioned, the people are very different.
Yeah.
The widow in Helping Hands is basically a desperate person. She's extremely desperate. She's not thinking clearly. She's at that stage in being a widow where she's just thinking maybe of suicide or madness. Or she's so despairingly lonely that the idea of giving her husband's clothes away, it's like she's bartering a few minutes of conversation. She's got these clothes and she'll have some company for half an hour. And then it gets more like a fantasy. And she has this pathetic fantasy, which in a way is not completely far-fetched. She thinks, well, I'll be friends with him. He'll take me to the opera, and he'll take me to dinner, and we'll go to Europe. You know, in a way, there are people, there are older women or widows who do have companions like that, and they're perfectly friendly, and it works out well. It's just that in this particular story, it's a desperate thing she's doing.
Yeah.
And then with Katya, she's from a very poor family. In fact, her family is broken up. It's a dysfunctional and broken family. So she's just awestruck by these people with their money, this beautiful house, and her desperation is a different kind of desperation. And she's also very young. She's only 15.
This concern for characters leads me to ask what I've long wondered, which is your editorial relationship to your various editors. What happens when, say, Dan Halpern over at Echo edits a story and, say, you know, the Otto Penzler situation gets edited another way? Are there any different working methods along these lines? Are there different forms of input? Is there line editing? Is it a large conceptual relationship? What happens here?
I don't really send anything out until I revise it quite a few times.
Yeah.
Even so, a story may go out and there'll be a couple words missing or a line missing in the printout.
Yeah.
And my editors are very alert and they find that out. Each work is sort of a special case.
Yeah.
But I don't send a novel out until I've pretty much gone over it again and again and again.
Yeah.
When I finish a novel, I quickly reread it and I start rewriting it right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll go through it completely and then I'll go back to the beginning and I'll, because of the computer now, we can do this so fast.
Yeah. You know?
So I can spend several days going through the novel. So by the time I send it to an editor, I've found a lot of mistakes and I've tightened things or added something.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are writers who send their editors first drafts immediately.
Yeah.
Because they want a lot of input. I mean, I have friends who do that. I think that maybe Russell Banks or Richard Ford works pretty closely with Dan Halpern, and they may show him one third of a novel.
Yeah.
Or one half. And they also may have contracts for the novel before they're finished.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have that, so I've never had a contract.
Really?
Never.
Do you have to finish the novel before you figure out the whole publication situation? Or I mean, I was always curious how the whole copyright, the Ontario Review thing works.
Well, I don't know what the advantage would be of signing a contract for a novel before it was written or finished. I would rather have it finished. If I signed a contract, if I took an advance, I would feel that I was obliged to write this novel. And what if it didn't turn out right?
Yeah.
What if I wanted to put it in a drawer?
Yeah.
You know, there's sort of ethical and moral problems. Whereas if you finish a novel, send it to your agent, agent sends it to an editor. If he wants it, he buys it.
Yeah.
And then there's a contract.
Yeah, yeah.
It just seems to me somehow easier in every way.
It also doesn't allow the business to impede in the artistic discovery, which I think seems to be a big factor in your work. Well, this also leads me to ask you, because I have read other interviews where you have said, I have to keep the novel in a drawer for a year so that I have no emotional connection with it.
That's
and
right.
I can approach it completely free. I'm wondering how this works for, say, short stories or even a fiction project where it might be an immediate response to a recent headline such as My Sister, My Love, and you feel utterly compelled to get it out there.
That wasn't recent. That's like 10, 15 years.
Okay.
So a long time went by. And I have a novel called Zombie, which I wrote like 15 years after the event. And another novella called Blackwater, which is 20 years after the event. So I don't really do things that fast. Now, with a short story, if someone wants a story for an anthology, the story is so much faster.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go through a story a couple of times in one day. You know, and after a week or so, I could send it to an editor without being worried that it was not complete. But recently, I wrote a story for a novella for Otto. My next book with Otto will be 4 novellas, and they're all about the same length. And he questioned the title, which is a kind of unusual title. And I wrote back and I explained why the title was what it was.
Yeah.
And how it related to the story. And the title that he had wanted was a very conventional one, like Our Secret.
Yeah.
The word secret to me is too familiar.
What was your title?
The Flatbed.
You know, oh, the truck? Yeah, I know the Flatbed.
The Flatbed,
yeah.
And to me, that's a specific entity, and it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Like you probably wouldn't see a story called The Flatbed.
No, I can't think of any story called The Flatbed.
No, but you would see a lot of stories called My Secret or The Secret or something. So I explained to him, and he wrote back and said, absolutely, I understand.
Yeah.
That's a good editor.
While we're on the subject of words, I have to point out that when I read anything of yours, I will always find the word glisten, no matter what.
Oh.
And this leads me to ask you about, I suppose, every author has their words that they like.
And I'm afraid I have other words, too.
Yes, there are. Do you fret about, say, using something like glisten too much or another word or anything?
I think I'm aware of it. Sometimes it just seems to be the word that I need.
Yeah.
Like the word glitter or gleam is not the same as glisten.
Yeah.
Glisten is like eyes glisten.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that the word shine is quite right, you know, like... If a person's very alert and his or her eyes are kind of alive, I don't know what other word for that. It's the opposite of dull.
Yeah.
But I have to be careful. And now, because of the computer, one can find these words more easily.
Yeah. Well, have you ever done what I understand Nicholson Baker does? He's so concerned about possibility of using the same phrase that he will do a control F through all of his novels. Do you do anything that obsessive? Or?
Well, I haven't done that.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. It's not a bad idea. I think anything that helps us write is good. There are writers like James Joyce who, in a long work like Ulysses, have certain formulaic, I hate to use that word in connection with James Joyce, there are certain structures, like formulas of words.
Yeah.
It's not always the same words, but a certain...
Syntax.
Syntax or rhythm.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can recognize a James Joyce sentence, you know, 100 feet away.
Yeah.
And it would have been maybe an obsessive thing for Joyce to try to root that out of his writing.
Yeah.
If he had the computer, maybe he would have. And maybe that's probably not a good idea to become obsessive.
You now have me conjuring a parallel universe in which Finnegan's Wake was written in the age of computers, creating a longer and more massive work. Yeah.
Well, it's so true. You probably know that Ulysses grew by 1/3.
Yeah.
In galleys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This also leads me to ask about certain similarities of feeling or images. There's one I actually noticed when I was doing some prep work for this conversation. In The Gravedigger's Daughter, you write, of all the household tasks, Rebecca loved vacuuming most. The roaring motor filled her head and drove out all thoughts. And then in A Widow's Story, I found, I run the vacuum cleaner through the rooms. I'm always happy vacuuming. The thrumming noise drowns out the noises inside my head. So I'm wondering if you take any steps to avoid that sort of same image. I mean, it works perfectly well, and it also is interesting seeing what you have personally felt reflected in one of your characters. But, you know, what do you do to sort of avoid situations like this, or do you embrace situations like this?
Well, I wouldn't consider that important.
Yeah.
one is a memoir and the other is fiction. And
yeah.
The two characters. But I've met many people who love the vacuum, so
yeah.
Maybe it's something that could be spread around. And some of them are men.
Yeah.
They really like vacuuming. It's actually...
I like vacuuming.
It's fun.
Yeah, it is. What about the feral cats that have been cropping up with greater frequency? Especially like feral cats wandering around a dumpster. I know you like cats, but feral cats in particular seem to be cropping up in Jersey, and so I'm wondering about this.
I don't write about them anymore.
Oh.
There were a bunch of feral cats near where we lived.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And around the dumpster. Beautiful. Beautiful feral cats.
Yeah.
And I have a story just called Feral.
Yeah.
But that's actually not about cats at all. It's about a boy who becomes sort of like an animal.
Sure. I also wanted to touch on New Jersey Noir a little bit. In the introduction for this, you point to how New Jersey's location has been very underestimated over the years.
Yes.
You point out that not even Martin Scorsese would wish to cross the line into the annals of real-life, unorganized New Jersey crime at its most extreme. I would argue that setting and location is very important in your work. Beersheba, you have Brad's discharge in Carthage, which was close by his hometown, but not too close he had to see his family often. So that omission tells us something interesting about where he might have been. There is Sparta, New York, this city that we see in Little Bird of Heaven with a waterfront, water houses, rubble-strewn vacant lots, high-rise condos and developments. Wholly fictitious, from what I understand, although there is, I know, a town called Sparta, New York. So I'm wondering how much setting you draw from reality, and to what degree do you need to invent direction or buildings or landmarks with which to kind of fill in the gaps that you won't necessarily find in your real peregrinations?
Well, the cities of Sparta and Carthage are modeled on post-industrial cities like Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, yeah.
And smaller cities like Lockport, New York, which is where I had lived. Buffalo was once quite a prosperous city, and it's lost much of its population.
Yeah.
I live quite near Buffalo. So when there's a city that's on a lake or near a great lake or on a canal or on a river with the waterfront and the old mills and the old factories that kind of shut down, that city is very much based on a real city.
Yeah.
And I lived in Detroit for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so these are real cities. I just give them different names.
Huh. Why don't you give them their real names? Is it a matter of just wanting to create a new association through fiction?
Well, I've written about Detroit.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wrote once about Buffalo in some detail, and I called it Union City.
Yeah.
If you were a writer, you would understand why sometimes you appropriate a place and give it a different name. It's so that you don't have to account for all that's there. I once wrote about a place like Princeton, where there's an Institute for Advanced Study, but I didn't want to put the university in.
Mm-hmm.
So I called it Hazleton on Hudson, and I shifted it to the Hudson River. So there it's the town of Princeton with the houses and the people and the history and the institute, but not the university. But if I called it Princeton, I'd have to have this university there. So
Yeah. There
are things that you do as a writer of fiction. Sometimes you want a real city. Like when people write about New York City, they tend to write about New York or Brooklyn. They tend to make that claim, you know, that the writing about this cosmopolitan city. If you gave a different name to New York, it wouldn't seem to work.
Yeah, yeah.
My friend Russell Banks has a new novel called Lost Memory of Skin, and it's set in Miami.
Yeah.
But he has a fictitious name. And that is a little strange because he describes Miami with the causeways and things. But yet, he doesn't call it Miami.
Yeah. Well, there's also J.B. Gordon's Champ of the City solo, which is New York instead of New York. So some people have no such problem about, you know, naming the city to something different. Or I guess you could make a case for Jonathan Lethem's Chronic City as well, you know.
Yeah, well, it is an interesting question. But with the upstate New York cities, I wanted classical names, something like Carthage. To me is a beautiful name. Cicero said, Carthage must be destroyed. Carthage must be destroyed. And Carthage and Sparta and other cities of upstate New York, they're being sort of destroyed from within because of economic depression.
Yeah. Yeah. In a 1982 keynote address you gave before a women writers conference, which was later collected in Woman Writer, you wrote about how a woman who writes is a woman writer by other people's definition. You wrote then, a writer may be afflicted by any number of demons, real or imagined, but only the woman writer is afflicted by her essential identity. So I'm curious, 30 years later, to what extent do you think that the paradox here has changed? I mean, you write of Joyce Carol Oates in quotes in A Widow's Story and many of your other pieces, but how much of that identity involves being pegged as a woman writer? I mean, is this sort of a extension of William James's question about the public self and how we all contain many of them, or?
Well, I don't know quite how to answer that. Yeah. I think when one is writing, when you're all alone writing, you don't have any particular identity. I'm more fascinated and concentrating on the story.
Yeah.
And the story has its own world and its own gravitational pull, and it can be very beautiful or terrifying, but I'm actually not thinking of my identity. When I was writing that, I was talking more about how one is perceived by the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that if you're a writer who's a woman, you're a woman writer. But if you're a writer who's a man, you're just a writer.
Yeah.
You know, so that's just a fact, I think. I'm not sure that it's always a disadvantage. There are many women writers who are bestsellers because they do have a woman or female audience.
Yeah. Well, you said that kind of thing before Chick Lit, and a lot of very talented women who write are unfortunately stigmatized by this needless label, and they have to write many books before they're accepted as writers, you know?
Well, I'm sure
like Kay Christensen is a wonderful writer who had this problem, too, you know?
Yeah, whereas if men write, a man like Richard Ford's The Sports Writer is a very, very macho, masculine novel, but nobody would call it a boy novel.
Yeah.
It's just a novel. It's a good novel. Whereas if you're writing about female subjects, you would say there's a woman writing.
Yeah. I suppose, do you think that this process of being pegged as some kind of genre writer, woman writer, literary fiction could even be a genre, that this is just an inescapable part of the process? Nothing you can really do? Or?
Well, I think it is an inescapable part of the process. Once in a while, a work of genre like a mystery or a work of surrealism or fantasy will cross over.
Yeah.
And be accepted in the mainstream. As you probably know, Margaret Atwood made a distinction between the kind of writing she does in The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
And she has two other fantasy or dystopian novels. She doesn't think of them as science fiction.
Yeah.
They're more speculative fiction.
And she got into trouble with that with Ursula K. Le Guin.
A lot of trouble.
Have you read In Other Worlds yet, her new essay collection?
Yeah. Yes, I actually reviewed it.
Oh, okay.
For the New York Review.
Okay.
And I think she makes a good point. But there's a lot about definitions that are sort of compulsive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it matters that much to define something. Dostoevsky was, in one sense, a brilliant crime writer and a writer about mystery, but he was other things too.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take the crime away from Dostoevsky, there's no novel.
Yeah.
And basically, that's what he's writing about.
Yeah. Then we get back into the situation where Raskolnikov didn't commit the murder.
Yeah.
Then there's no narrative.
There's no narrative.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, actually, I wanted to ask you about the epistolary format. I've seen this in a Princeton Idol contained in Dear Husband, the letters which close out The Grave Digger's Daughter, the many letters that are contained in A Widow's Story. Do you think that that contemporary fiction has lost its ability to inhabit this epistolary situation? Or?
Well, it may.
Yeah.
It may increasingly, but then there'll just be emails.
Yeah.
Or tweeters.
Tweets, yeah.
Tweets and Twitters and so forth will take the place. But there's nothing quite like reading letters.
Yeah.
When letters have a kind of dramatic structure and relationship.
Yeah.
So I love that. That was, for me, the ideal way to end The Gravedigger's Daughter.
Yeah.
But these two people, these two women, are survivors from a terrible past, and they're writing to each other's soul. They're writing deep to the heart, which you can do with a letter much more than just talking with people.
Yeah. It's also a more sustained narrative, I suppose, as well. Oh, you also have mentioned that the first 6 weeks of writing a novel involve a great deal of unhappiness for you. Is this always the case? Like, I would think that with My Sister, My Love, you were probably having a ball. Or were you?
No, I had a lot of trouble with that because I had to get the voice right. To get the voice right is not always that easy.
Yeah.
I had a lot of material that I had to cut back. I had to begin with just the right paragraph, with the right sentences. I got the right paragraph, I thought, almost immediately, but then the next paragraph. And I had to move. No, I did a lot of work on that.
Huh.
A lot of work.
Does this often explain why there are sometimes short chapters after these very long ones? It's a matter of moving paragraphs around to get that right kind of voice?
That would depend on which work it was.
Yeah.
But when you have a nice voice that you're working with, it's a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And my friend T.C. Boyle,
yes.
Tom Boyle, he says that he finds that writing gives him a rush better than any drug. He had once taken heroin.
Yeah.
And I don't know about that. I haven't had heroin. But he loves to write, and I guess I have that feeling too, that when the voice is working well, it's very thrilling.
Yeah.
And it's like if you're a dramatist and you're watching actors really, really doing well with your play. But then when it's not going quite right, when there's a certain obtuseness to everything, or opaqueness, then it's very frustrating.
Well, on that note of frustration and hopeful voices, I know you have a reading to give. Joyce, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.